Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Beavers have been called nature's engineers. In fact, the Army Corps of Engineers could learn a lot from beavers. Instead of re-engineering nature to serve narrow human interests, beavers engineer the natural environment to serve not just their own needs, but the needs of entire ecosystems. Before beavers were newly extirpated from the Pacific Northwest over 100 years ago, stream corridors were filled with beavers, creating and maintaining complex water-rich habitats that provided homes and food for a diverse array of fish and mammals, as well as humans. Today we talk with Dr. Suzanne Fauti, a retired U.S. Forest Service hydrologist, about the importance of protecting the beaver, who is still doing their best to survive in our forests and wetlands, despite harassing, trapping, and hunting by people who do not appreciate the vast benefits they provide. Suzanne is a co-author of House Bill 2843 that would close recreational and commercial trapping of beaver on federal public lands in Oregon. Suzanne, welcome to Locus Focus.
Barbara, thank you so much for having me.
A number of years ago, I was working on a documentary about salmon, and I found out about this group in eastern Oregon around the John Day River that was doing salmon restoration by basically restoring beaver habitat. And they had a bumper sticker that somebody sent me, which was, "Beaver taught salmon to jump." So I wanted to start by talking about that whole notion. What does that mean, that beaver taught salmon to jump?
I think in many respects, it's that sense that salmon and beaver have sort of co-evolved together, and that the dams in there creating of ponds and wetlands and all these amazing side channels and all this really complicated habitat was something that salmon needed. And so the idea was that occasionally a salmon migrate from the ocean into the main streams, and as they head up into their headwater systems, inevitably you start to run into beaver dams because that's the right size. And so for salmon to figure out how to make it to their spawning grounds, it was the idea of, well, that salmon was going to have to learn how to get over those beaver dams. And in some cases, they got around them because there's all kinds of side channels. But I think it comes from the fact that as the beaver were learning how to build dams and the salmon were migrating, there was this like, oh, you put a dam there. Okay, well, I'm going to figure out how to get around it. Yeah. And so it's the idea is that these two species are really linked and that they're very important. They're keystone species in their own way, and they have co-evolved together. In many respects, both species are incredibly generous in terms of what they provide for human beings and what they provide for other species.
Well, Jim Likatovich, who's a salmon expert who lives northwest of Portland, was telling me a story a number of years ago about this beaver dam that he encountered on some stream. And there was this huge beaver dam in it. And he was wondering, how are the salmon going to be able to get over this dam? And so then he came back during the salmon run when, of course, it had rained a lot. And that dam had lifted up and sort of moved over from the current. And so the salmon were just migrating up this rapids, no problem at all. And then the beaver would come back afterwards and put the dam back. And I thought, what a great model for the Army Corps of Engineers.
Yes, indeed, indeed. This idea of being very flexible and allowing transportation and processes to happen, and then just sort of coming back and tidying things up again.
Well, let's talk about what the landscape was like when there were millions of beaver living in the Northwest, as opposed to now. I'm not sure how many there are now, and I think they may be coming back, I'm not sure, compared to where they were at the very beginning of the 20th century. But let's describe the kind of habitat they create and why that's so vital.
When we think about that, what happened in the Pacific Northwest, you know, gets its start on the East Coast. And it's this whole idea of settlers arrive, and beaver are everywhere. They're streams. I mean, they are the architectures of the landscape that settlers arrive in. They, by building their dams, creating their side channels, these dams pond water. The water becomes, you know, spills onto the valley floor. We have these amazing wetlands, this very complicated, lush, incredibly robust habitat that is very able to adapt to changes in weather. So dry years, you've got all this stored water, the rivers continue to flow. Wet years, the wetlands sort of dampen the flood peaks. When we arrived, whether it was the East Coast or on the West, the trappers take them out. And the critical element here is that dams have to be maintained. And so when the beaver were taken out, the dams over time begin to fail. And as they fail, the streams begin to downcut, channels may begin to widen. And as those streams downcut, the water table adjusts accordingly, and it starts to move down too. And there was this period where there was a sort of a holding pattern. So the trappers had come through, the streams are adjusting, and then what we have is livestock grazing and logging and agriculture, and the cities are being built and the towns are being built and the roads are being put in. And all of those things are acting on these valley floors that were once beaver wetlands and acting, you know, taking out vegetation. And so the streams go to an entirely different new state. And then they widen again and they downcut again and the water tables drop further. And so what you have is this period of unraveling that takes place. And what's interesting to me as a scientist and somebody who's been looking at this aspect of beaver and streams, not only in modern day, but also historically, is that for a long time, we scientists did not understand the role of beavers. We missed the signature. And it was really interesting because the reason is that the timing of settlement, except for on the East Coast, is separated from the timing of trapping. So the trappers come through, landscape arranges, the rivers change, settlers arrive. Then the general land office surveys begin, and they're doing this on these linear grids. So they see beavers, they see some wetlands, but the trappers go up the streams, and the land officer, the land surveyors are doing grid lines. So they don't register that beaver are significant. They're there. But because they're not traveling up the stream corridors, they're not just seeing dam after dam after dam. The beaver trappers don't leave good records. The general land office leaves fantastic records. And that's what we use as our source. So it is only until we get to the modern day. So when the scientists show up and start really studying the science, and there are some amazing scientists in the 40s, 50s, and 60s who are just the foundation. They're using the general land office information. They see beavers, but again, not a major part of the landscape. As time goes on, people start to study, and we now have GIS and Google Earth, and we have access to all this information on the web. The connections, all the pieces that are sort of scattered about suddenly become available. And so what you see is this real growing awareness in the 90s of the power of beavers and the fact that it wasn't a local event, trapping. It was a regional event, and that the streams unraveled. And what that sets in motion is systems now that are more sensitive to climate. Not the habitat isn't as good for salmon and fish. The habitat isn't as good for migratory birds. And by the time we're done grazing and logging and building cities and things like that, we've really shifted the conditions. So we're looking at systems now that have dramatically altered. And in the lower places like the Willamette River, there were once a lot of beavers, but they were lots of side channels. And now the Willamette is channelized and it's too big for beavers. But on federally managed public lands and these headwater systems, this is ideal size for places where beavers can build dams and begin to restore those stream processes, restore those wetlands, restore that fish and wildlife habitat.
Well, actually, I live next to probably the largest beaver pond in Portland. It's Oaks Bottom, and it's right on the Willamette River in the South Reach, just south of downtown. And there's an amazing story I was told about why that pond exists. It's basically a wetland that was separated from the river by a railroad berm back over 100 years ago. And so the wetland kind of dried out and it was kind of gnarly. And the river, of course, is suffering also from not being connected to its floodplain. And there had been a lot of beavers in that area, but they were being trapped out by the railroad. Then I think sometime in the 70s, the railroad was stopped from trapping the beavers anymore. I think that's when there was starting to be an awareness that the beavers were endangered and they needed to be protected. So the beavers came back to Oaks Bottom, and there was a culvert that went under the berm, and it went from the Willamette River into Oaks Bottom, and it was basically just a trickle of water. So the beaver, I guess, when the river was high and it was flooding Oaks Bottom, they built a dam in the culvert. And they basically dammed it up and we had this big pond. And then for years, the Parks Department, which was restoring Oaks Bottom as a wildlife refuge, like negotiated with the beaver about, you know, how to build the dam. They finally put in a water control structure that had a removable bar. And so they worked it out with the beavers, and I guess they're happy. Every so often you see beavers in Oaks Bottom, but you see beaver dams and chewed willows and all kinds of signs of beaver there. So it's interesting, even though it's on the main stem of the Willamette, it's even possible to restore beaver to the habitat of a big river like the Willamette if you basically start protecting it, I guess, from the outside in.
I think so too. And the other thing too is that the size of the stream that they were actually building on was not the Willamette. It's something that's feeding the Willamette, right? And so it was a size that they could build a dam and adjust on and stuff like that. Yeah, so down even in the Willamette or any of these large streams that have side channels and small tributaries, you can get beavers on those as well. That's a great story.
Well, I want to look back at when the first white settlers came, and maybe even, I'm not sure about the trappers, I'm not sure what their mentality was, but I got the feeling, because I've heard these stories, that settlers came to the Willamette Valley and to the rest of the Northwest and thought it was just this incredible parkland. And they just thought nature had just endowed this incredible parkland. But the reality of it was land that had been managed for tens of thousands of years by Native Americans, and prior to that, for I don't know how many million years, by beaver. I want to talk about the way that the beaver and the indigenous people here interacted and interconnected in their stewardship of the landscape, and how that changed when both of these entities were nearly wiped out.
All right, I'm a scientist. I'm not as good on my history. I guess I'll take that story from a science perspective. You know, part of it is mentality of one's relationship to the landscape and one's relationship to other species. And the Europeans' relationship to other species and to the landscape tends to be one of consumption, to taking these natural resources that are ours to use. It's ours to dominate. That was sort of the mindset that was coming there. And so, you know, beaver had value for hats. Trees had value for timber. Land had value for farming. Wildlife deer and elk had value for food and for market. But I also think there's an issue of sheer numbers. So you also have this constant influx of people showing up. And they're also showing up on a landscape that's already gone through at least two major changes. One, which is the removal of the beavers because the trappers come through. But my understanding is too, is that as there was this contact with either the trappers or other tribes that had interacted with Euro-Americans, disease came. And so it's also the settlers are arriving on a landscape where maybe there's been a real reduction in the vibrancy of some of these native, these tribal nations, because they've been dealing with things like smallpox. So again, I'm not a history buff in terms of the Willamette Valley, but the attitude would have been different. You are managing your, you know, those fires that they would allow to periodically burn to bring the grasses back. But also there wasn't the nature of the habitation that oftentimes many of the tribal nations had was not these wood structures that had to be protected from fire. So there was a flexibility in dealing with fire. There is also a change in technology. And I think that change in technology also is a real game changer. You know, you've got mechanisms that can dredge things. You've got mechanisms that can straighten streams. You're talking about bringing in railroads and driving them down the middle. So you're looking at a time when technology is changing. The attitude that is coming with those settlers is it's about finding land that they can call theirs. The native people are not considered prior owners. It's a very strange thing. And they are the tribal nations repeatedly find their treaties being removed. When it came to salmon, it wasn't about salmon as spiritual, cultural, important, integral first food. It was about how much money could large corporations make at the time. And so there was just huge amounts of salmon taken. So that whole idea of how much money can be made for a few people, it's actually the same. I mean, a lot of these people were from the East Coast who were benefiting by the rich resources. And it wasn't about how do we maintain these for the long term. It was about how do we get those resources out for the short term and generate. And that is a real different perspective because you're taking resources out of an area. And so, and the people who are benefiting from those resources that are leaving the area are not impacted by the result of taking those out. When you're living in an area and all your resources are coming from that area, you are very much more mindful. Your relationship to those resources is a much more partnership, interchange between you on some level, whether it's spiritual or cultural, of equals, because there's the recognition that you must have them. If you're on the East Coast and you're benefiting by all those trees coming out from the Pacific Northwest, you're not thinking about what's happening to the hill slopes.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM, KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dr. Suzanne Fauti, co-author of House Bill 2843, that we're going to be talking about very shortly, that would close recreational and commercial trapping of beaver on federally managed public lands in Oregon. Before we get to the nitty-gritty of this legislation that you've been working to get passed, I just wanted to spend a little bit more time just sort of imagining the kind of landscapes that beavers create, and maybe comparing that. I mean, you've talked a little bit about what took its place here in the Willamette Valley, for sure, and all throughout much of Oregon. But let's talk more scientifically about what this landscape was, how the different parts of a beaver-engineered landscape nourished each other.
Would you mind if I slightly shifted that question?
Go right ahead.
What I would like to talk about instead is imagining a landscape in which beaver return and compare it to what we have now. So right now what we have is stream temperatures of tens of thousands of miles that exceed the state standard. So it compromises water quality for human beings and human communities, and it compromises water quality and habitat needs for salmon and for other species. We have thousands and thousands of miles in which the streams are completely separated from their valley floors. The valley floors are sagebrush, conifers are moving in. That when the spring runoff comes, those streams, instead of acting as places where water gets onto the floodplain, it slows down, it sinks into the ground and is stored, it races out like fire hoses. Does a lot of damage downstream, because as that energy collects, as the tributaries move in, as we've seen, we can have some pretty serious flooding. We have right now landscapes on federally managed public lands and throughout the state where the trees have moved in, we've lost the wetlands. So when we have a wildfire like we had in September on the west side, and wildfires that we've had prior years on the east side where I live, what we have is there is no fire breaks. There is no water to meet fire. So the fire comes down, it hits what once was a wetland area, but now it's trees or dry grass. It whips across and heads up the other side. What does that mean for livestock? What does that mean for wildlife? So you got a fire that's moving really fast, and if you're a cow or you are wildlife, you know there's only one safe place, and that's the river. But if all you've got is a trickle, so the fact that you're standing in a meadow, but the fire is moving down and it's burning up the trees that have managed to move in because the water table's so low, you are in this situation where you end up with a lot of dead life. So let's imagine what it means if we put those beavers back. So the beavers begin to move up into these streams, and these streams are the right size. So it's important to recognize they can't build dams everywhere. But on federally managed public lands, the streams are the right size. They begin to build their dams, and these dams pond water. And as the water is ponded, the water table begins to rise, because now when we have a storm, instead of racing down, the water fills up what's left of the pond, spills out onto the valley floor, sinks into the ground, and the water's stored. The vegetation starts to change. It's not sagebrush anymore, and it's not grass. It's willows and cottonwoods and alder and sedges. And other species start to move in. The birds, the insects, the mammals. Because the habitat suddenly is really interesting and really complicated. And there's homes for all kinds of species. The wetland expands. And now let's imagine a wildfire. The wildfire is racing down the hillside. The winds are changing. You're a rancher. You've got cows out on public land. And you know that the fire is where your cows are. And you are headed up there to try to figure out if you can cut fences to give them a chance at safety. You have to leave. The fire's too big. Now you go there in the aftermath. And you're walking around wondering what you're going to see. The ground is dusty. The forest is charred trees right now. And you come to a wetland, and there your cows are. They're standing there. And they're alive. And maybe you even see some other animals and wildlife that have basically come in here. And instead of seeing this massive economic and emotional loss, you are suddenly in the gift, one of the gifts that beaver has just given you. Your livelihood just made it through a wildfire. So you gather your cows out and you take them home. And in the meantime, all that wildlife that is going to need habitat to make it through the winter, the wetlands will provide. When the spring melt comes and there's sediment coming off those hillsides, the wetlands will trap it. So the water quality that comes down to cities and towns that provides for fish is better. All of that magic happens, but it only happens because the beaver dams are there And they are maintained by beavers. You take the beavers out, the dams go away, and the whole system reverts back. So what we need to do is recognize that what we're asking, what this bill is asking, House Bill 2843, is saying, let's partner with this really extraordinary animal that's our state animal. It's Oregon State University's mascot. It's a keystone species. They can do all this action for free. And we can have all these benefits and the hundreds of millions of dollars. We just have to do one thing. We have to take the one cause of death that we control. We have to take that pressure off them, because we've got to give them time to expand in their numbers. That means right now trapping takes place during the breeding season and the pregnancy season. Unlike a hunter's, where you look and you're like, it's a doe, but I'm in the buck season, so I'm not touching that doe. A trap doesn't know if it's a female or a male. It just takes whatever there. So by taking that pressure off, by taking that 24/7 cause of mortality that traps do, what you end up doing is allow the numbers to expand. And that means the dams get to expand, the habitat gets to expand, and the benefits get to expand.
Now, how would somebody who lives like in the Willamette Valley and has never seen a beaver or knowingly seen a beaver, how does this relate to their lives?
I would say, is there anybody out there who doesn't drink water? Is there anybody out there this summer or this fall, September, who did not feel the impact of fire? Whether it was watching your town and your house burn down, or it was trying to breathe air because it was so thick. What does it mean if you happen to just like wildlife and you know that migratory birds have a long way to go, and how neat is it if we could create all these resting sites? So what does it mean? Does it mean you have to see beavers in order for them to be valuable to your life? The answer is no. What you have instead is a recognition is that when you turn that tap on and that water comes out, it comes from someplace. In many places, it's coming from federally managed public lands that we all have a major say in. And what beaver are doing is they're actively on those lands helping to maintain that water quality. So as it works its way down, the quality stays better. It's up to those of us on the downstream end to make sure as it moves through our towns and our farms and our ranches that we maintain it. If you like to fish, then what happens is that you've got all this great habitat up there. So when those salmon finally make it up there, or those red band trout, they've got great spawning grounds. So you don't have to see beavers to know that they're doing these really incredible things. What you need, though, is an understanding of their role in the system. And so what I would say is that if you're in the Willamette and you turn on a tap, think, wow, this water comes from my public lands. And if we could get beavers up there, that's really important, because I know that when we go into drought, we suddenly have water restrictions. So maybe this could help us. I read in the paper about salmon going belly up because the temperatures are too high. Maybe this would make a difference. So I think it's that. It is, just because you can't see it doesn't mean it's not working. It's incredible magic. It's incredible benefits. I guess that's what I would say.
I'm wondering how the numbers of beaver today compare with the numbers after the trappers went through their first round of wiping out beavers. I got the impression that in the 19th century, trappers did a pretty good job of killing most of the beavers in the Northwest. Am I correct about that?
Pretty much until around the 1830s, 1840s, when the fur trade disappeared. That's one big, they're not needed anymore. And then the other thing has to do with the whole fur desert and the competition between the Hudson Bay Company wanting to keep the Americans out and basically giving instructions to their trappers to go get them out of the streams. They're coming here, because, and part of the draw is beaver. Get rid of the beavers. So yeah, it was a pretty much, what would you call it, a seek and destroy approach. And of course, you don't get them all. But yes, it was a very big decision. And in the west side of the state, there was a lot of that, of just get rid of them. But so it's sort of complicated. Part of it is the trappers are coming for the pelts. And then you've got this competition between the British Hudson Bay and the Americans that are coming over, and the Hudson Bay saying, well, if it's beaver they're coming for, let's get rid of the beavers because we're interested about maintaining our territory. So it was an accelerated I would say it was probably like an accelerated trapping experience with a very different mindset. Not beavers necessarily for hats, but getting the beavers to keep the Americans out.
It's interesting to me that, as you mentioned, Oregon is the beaver state. The city right to the west of Portland is Beaverton. I mean, there's a lot of identification with beavers, and yet it seems like we've done a really good job in the last 150 years or so to do as much as possible to destroy the beaver. Why do you think we have the beaver as our icon, and at the same time we have such a hard time protecting it?
I think that the beaver is an icon not because of its ecosystem services. The beaver is an icon because it was economically valuable. And it was part of Oregon's economic framework. What's interesting about your question is that those of us who are supporting the House Bill 2843 is saying the beaver on our flag, it's even more valuable as a partner in ecosystem restoration. Its pelts, its castoreum that comes out of its anal glands, they're small, they're nothing. But their ecosystem services, we need to be like, yeah, keep the beaver on the flag, but it's about, its importance now is totally different. It's about water, it's about habitat, it's about climate change, it's about salmon, it's not about hats. And so the reason for the beaver, why the beaver goes on the flag is the economic value back then, but it has a much greater significance now.
You've made some references to beavers and hats. Actually, I did a show a number of years ago with a woman who wrote a book. It was called Once They Were Hats. It's a good book. But I wanted to just talk a little bit about the role that beavers played in the hat industry and how that's what actually perpetuated the beaver trade for so long, or beaver trapping for so long. Is that correct?
It was a fashion statement. Those who were wealthy could have great hats. And again, I'm not a historian, but yeah, it had real value. The European beaver had been pretty much removed. You arrive, it's still the fashion. Pelts have huge value. And so, you know, so it becomes a form of currency with Europe. And when that changes, when there's a shift to silk hats, you know, which is sort of at the time that the numbers are crashing, you see this change. But yeah. It was just a form of currency.
Now, once the silk hat supplanted the beaver hat as this fashion statement, did that help beaver numbers to at least plateau at a low level as opposed to be totally extirpated?
I think that's probably a reasonable assumption. You know, beaver trapping, you're looking at a group of individuals. That's what they did. They trapped beaver. They trapped beaver for economic reasons or for geopolitical reasons. When that's kind of done, what you now have is people focusing on settlement, on grazing, on building towns, on agriculture. The focus is shifting. Now, the trapping continues probably, but it now has a very different reason. You got beavers in your dams. You got to get rid of them. They're taking down your trees. You got to get rid of them. There isn't a lot of them, so they're not as much of a problem. But over time, those numbers do begin to increase. And what's really interesting about Oregon has had two times when it has closed almost the entire state to beaver trapping for up to 20 years. One in the late 1899 to about 1919. Parts of it are reopened again, and then it's closed again 1932 to 1952. And those were for resource reasons. So you see this period where what is the beginning of Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, the game department, you know, they're making these choices. And, you know, beaver trapping is open again because they're starting to get a lot of complaints because in 20 years the numbers increase. Then the numbers go down. There's concern about resources again. They close it again. And then in 1952, they opened them again. So there is a change about why beaver are trapped, but there's also this growing recognition, even early, we're talking early 1900s, that beaver have a value in terms of water and providing for irrigation. There is a great 1924 publication, I believe it is. It's all about how beaver can be used to help irrigation because they store this water. So it's kind of a mixed relationship with beavers.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dr. Suzanne Fauti, author of House Bill 2843 that would close recreational and commercial trapping of beaver on federally managed public lands in Oregon. Well, you're talking about how there's kind of a mixed message that people are giving themselves about beaver. But I wanted to look at the ways that beavers are seen as nuisance animals. But why are people so antagonistic in many ways to beavers?
Beavers are amazing animals, but they are also really determined. And if you've just created a great hazelnut orchard and beavers move up and they decide those are fantastic trees to use to make dams and food, I'd be annoyed as well, seriously, you know. You've got an irrigation ditch and things are going great and the water's arriving on your field and suddenly it's not arriving. And you walk the line and you discover that a beaver's built a dam and it's over top the ditch and the water's running down the hillside instead of onto your field. Or you've got your Oregon Department of Transportation and it's the spring and things, you've got a storm coming and you get out there and you discover that beavers have partially blocked a culvert and the water's running over the road and you're like, not here. And so it is very logical that people have this very mixed emotional relationship. You may be like, I like beavers. I like the dams. It's great. And now the next thing I know, my basement's being flooded because my house is next to the river and the pond has flowed over and it's now. So it's completely understandable. They are marvelous creatures. They are determined and they build ponds and this is what they do. And we sometimes put our houses and structures in places that intersect. And so what the neat thing about it is that now here in the 21st century, there's just a lot of knowledge about what beavers do and how to work with them. So, there are folks out there who do what they call non-lethal conflict resolution methods. And those are things like pond levelers. Okay, I can have you here, but you can't flood my barn. And so the pond can never get any higher than this. You can be in this area where you've made some great habitat, but I can't let you plug that culvert. And the beauty of this non-lethal control approach is that if the habitat's there and you take the beaver out, another beaver just shows up eventually, and you're back to having to deal with it again. And if you're a roads manager and you're forever going and there's beaver there and you're taking them out, and then one day you can't get there in time, and the next thing you know, your road's blown out, how much better would it have been to have said, beaver are territorial. If I can create a scenario where this family sticks around and we resolve our differences, then I know my buddy, I know my partner, any other beaver coming through is moving on. I don't have to worry that in the middle of the night, a beaver has shown up unexpectedly and has cut my trees down or is building a dam that's going to flood a road or block a culvert. And then there's easy ways to protect your trees. So again, but the tricky part is you have to decide you want to take that approach. But if you're interested in terms of economically protecting your investments, it's the smarter approach. Because sooner or later, a beaver's going to show up when you're not around to get rid of them right away, and you're going to lose your economic investment. So the idea is, okay, you get to stay. I'm going to set some ground rules here. I'm going to benefit a bunch. You're going to benefit, and it'll be okay. And I can leave and go on vacation and know that my trees or my culvert or my barn is not going to be flooded. You know, we've learned a lot, and we can take that knowledge and actually prevent a lot of problems.
I've seen the kinds of tree guards you can put around, particularly willows and other trees that beavers love. But how do you negotiate with a beaver about where they build the dam and how high they let the pond behind the dam get?
Human beings and beavers, we have a lot in common. We're incredibly ingenious and we're incredibly determined to resolve problems. So they're called pond levelers. If you decide that you want the dam only to, the water level to only get a certain height, then what you do is there are folks that can come in and they put a big pipe in, and that pipe separates the leak, which is upstream in the pond, and then they put it through the dam, and the discharge point is downstream of the dam. And so for the beaver, the dam isn't leaking, but the water levels are being held at a certain place. And because the water levels are being held at a certain place, there isn't really this need to build a taller dam. You build a taller dam because you're getting the water spilling over, or you're building a taller dam because you need deeper water for habitat. But the pond leveler just says, this is it. It can get this high and no higher. And you want someone to come in who knows what they're doing and basically do that. And this is the fun part of a landowner, if you catch it in time, it's like, so what really is important to me? What can I have flooded? What can I not have flooded? What am I willing to share? And what am I basically saying? Nope, this is the border. This is the land. This is the end point.
So why do beavers build dams to create the ponds?
It's a safety mechanism. So, you know, there's lots of big streams where they don't need to build dams because the water's deep enough. They can build bank dens. They have ways of moving about. But when you get into these smaller streams, these first through fourth order streams, which you tend to find either on federally managed public lands or, in your case, tributaries to major streams like the Willamette, the stream isn't that big. So the only way to create the water depth and the breadth of the water enough to keep you safe, because you're amazing underwater, but you're not very mobile, you know, walking around the land, is to create the dams. So the dams create ponds and expand your depth and your width of your area. And that just gives you a lot, an area of safety. And then you can either build a lodge, depending on the size of the pond, or you might still decide to build a bank den. But it's really to create the water depths and the size of a water zone that allows you to move about safely.
Well, I'm thinking on the one hand, there's the ranchers and farmers and highway engineers who have this kind of tenuous, if not negative, relationship with beaver. And then I think about people who come down to Oaks Bottom who are generally more on the nature lover side, particularly kids. And it's been only a couple times I've actually seen beaver visibly in the pond. But there was a beaver a couple years ago lying on this log or sitting on the log chewing a stick. And actually just a few days earlier, there had been a river otter lying on the log and just rolling around and being a cute river otter. This is like how animals come and become cliches of themselves in a place where there's a lot of people. So this beaver was chewing on a stick and being a beaver, and people were so drawn to it. Since then, there's been many supposed beaver sightings. People are saying, I see a beaver, and sorry, it's a nutria. Some people are disappointed. Some people don't know what a nutria is, and so they don't know that they should be disappointed. But I think about that excitement that beavers generate compared to seeing a nutria. And so what is it, do you think, that makes people so excited when they see a beaver?
I think that they are family animals. They're engaging. They create structures that change the landscape. I think we also have all grown up maybe with stories about beavers. And so we have an emotional attachment, sort of a knowledge about them, their characters and stories. I think that's the source of a lot of it. And also there's just something about this animal that creates this wonderful habitat and is cruising around. And if it gets startled, makes a big slap and it makes a big noise and then just quietly dips below the water. I think there's just something kind of enchanting about it and enchanting about wildlife, you know, that we get to engage with. Because oftentimes as we live in cities, we don't get an opportunity to do that. And we tend to think of beavers as wild. And so there's something really special about being given it. I've only seen a few. In one of my field sites, I just have to say, I have spent many years measuring stream temperatures. Two falls ago, for the first time, I'm out there in the evening, I'm dropping my temperature loggers in, and I see a ripple in the water, and I'm thinking it's the dog, and then going, now why is the dog underwater? And all of a sudden up pops the beaver, swims around, looks at me, and then just dips beneath the water. And you would have thought it was Christmas. I mean, and I've been doing this for a long time. So there is something very special about these animals. They're very intelligent. So I think it's just a mix of things. They're cool animals.
I wonder also, what can we learn from beavers?
I think we can learn from beavers. You know, we talk about busy beavers and they're very diligent in maintaining their dams. But I think that they're very family oriented. They're really good at making sure their kits are prepared to head out into the great wide world with the skills they need to survive. But I think there's something more fundamental we can learn from beavers. And that is about generosity. And that is about that they are part of a much larger world. And so when they're building a dam, and all these other species are benefit, whether it's improved salmon survival, whether it's herons arriving, migratory birds, insects, there's this incredible amount of life that responds to the presence of water that beaver create. And nobody, and beaver never say, I'm sorry, heron, you're out of here. Salmon, juvenile salmon, you cannot share our pond. No, instead it's like, oh yeah, this is what we do. We create this habitat, You come, and this is part of your habitat too. So generosity, I think, is something that's really important. The idea that we're all in this together, the idea that there is this, that we have all these interesting neighbors and we're all different, and yet we bring a real enhancement to our life. If there was, I mean, the plants give to the beaver, because if there are no plants, you can't build a beaver dam. So even the plants are interacting with the beaver. And I think it's that. It's about generosity. It's about how much more interesting it is when we have all kinds of different species. And if we're talking about human beings, how much more interesting is it when we respect the fact that we are different and that we have different life experiences, different talents, different backgrounds, and that that difference is really enriching. And that's when you go to a beaver pond, as opposed to an area that doesn't have a beaver pond, that the difference in the amount of life and energy and creativity that's in that area is orders of magnitude. And that's what they can teach us. If we share, things are just definitely better.
Well, I also have given a lot of thought to how our engineers could learn from beavers. I've made jokes with people I've worked with, you know, about how the Army Corps of Engineers should really hire some beavers and they'd build much better dams. But I just wonder if you've thought about that too. I mean, about the lessons we can learn about the way that we engineer the landscape, and maybe looking at the way that beavers do it and how that could inform us to do things in a way that are far more sustainable and resilient.
Yes. I think that if we all acknowledge that rivers are really important, that water is essential, that keeping water on the landscape is really important, that creating these wetlands as natural fire breaks and places to store water for dry years or to store water during flood times and slow it down, what we can do is that if we recognize that's all important, then what we do is we start to look at how we use the landscape. So maybe those floodplains, we shouldn't develop them. Or if we develop on them, we make sure we have nice green zones that can be flooded. What we do is we look at those systems and we say, you know, those are really important. And so what we're going to do is we make sure that we manage our livestock grazing on public lands, or we manage how we log, how we use the landscape, where we put our roads. And we manage those landscapes and we do those things in a way that enhances the health of the watershed, because the health of the watershed determines the health of our communities. And I think part of what it is respecting that a river needs space and species need space, and they need great habitat and connectivity, and stream riparian areas are really critical. So as we're thinking about how do we move into the 21st century, how do we deal with climate change and our growing numbers, is to say, rivers are important, we have to have water, let's figure out how to coexist with this, what it oftentimes feels like a living being, and create our cities and towns where our roads are that allow for the river to have its space. And when we do that, what we're doing is kind of mimicking the beaver, because we're acknowledging that there is other things besides our immediate need to put our house here or to put our road here. And in that process, we are beginning to do that same sort of generous interaction that beavers do, where they benefit from the plants, they enhance the plants, they enhance the insects.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCPB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. Today we're talking with Dr. Suzanne Fauti, who's co-author of House Bill 2843 that would close recreational and commercial trapping of beaver on federally managed public lands in Oregon. So let's talk more about this House bill now. Let's get into the political side, which probably is not as much fun as talking about the science and nature of beaver. But what is the purpose of this bill and why is it necessary?
The purpose of the bill is to basically set Oregon and Oregon's fish and wildlife and to get them ready for climate change, to prepare our communities, wild and human, to give them as many strategies, as best conditions as possible so that they can handle drought, flood, fire. The reason for the bill is that currently under the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife Division, you can trap and hunt beavers from November 15th to March 15th. And that's also the breeding season and the pregnancy season. And when beavers have kits, those kits stick around. They're there for a couple years and they're learning the skills. So if you're trapping, and unlike hunting, which is very focused, and you can say, don't take a doe during a buck season or don't take a buck during a doe season, you can't do that. You have a form of death, a form of mortality that is on the landscape. As long as that trap's out there, it's on the landscape and it's indiscriminate. So you could get a little kit that's just about ready to head off. You could get the pregnant female. You could get the male. You could end up trapping the entire colony. And what that does is it sets back stream recovery. And if that family or that mated pair suddenly has built three dams and things are just starting to come back and you take those beavers out, those dams will fail. And so all those benefits that you were just about to get going disappear. So the bill is really an attempt to improve conditions on federally managed public lands by giving beavers a level of protection from the only cause of death we can control. If there's a cougar cruising by and a beaver is out there and it's a tasty treat and the cougar gets it, there's nothing we can do about it. If a tree falls on a beaver, nothing we can do about it. If they get sick and a whole colony gets wiped out by disease, nothing we can do about it. If we have people who are illegally trapping and hunting, we can't do anything about it. But we can do something about this. And there are studies that show, and it would make sense, if you are no longer killing pregnant females, your populations will go up. If you are no longer killing the young kit that are about ready to head out, your populations will go up. So what this is about is giving them the level of protection that they need so their numbers can start going up on these landscapes that are the right size for beavers to build their dams on. So it's the only protection we can give them. And we actually need all their services. We need their water quality improvements. We need improved salmon runs. We need better fish and wildlife habitat. We need it connected. We need better stream flows. We need natural fire breaks. The wetlands are also great carbon capture and store. It's this free way to deal with climate change by sucking carbon out of the air and putting it in the veg and putting it in the soil. So there's all these benefits we need, but we can't get them unless we get the beavers building the beaver dams and maintaining the beaver dams. And the only way we can do that is to give them the best advantage we have to actually survive. So that's what the House bill does. And what's important to note is that, yes, the House bill says you can't trap and hunt beavers on public lands, these federally managed public lands. Those lands make up about 50% of the state. The other 50% of the state stays open. You can trap and hunt beavers on state lands, public lands. If you have permission of a landowner, you can trap and hunt beavers on their private lands. We're just saying 50% of the state, this place where the water is the source of, where the fish move to spawn, where the migratory birds, where we need all that water storage for downstream communities, we're saying that that landscape has a different set of values. It has a different purpose. And what we need is beavers out there on the landscape doing that. If you want to trap, there are other places you can do that. The other thing that's really important to note is that when we talk about who benefits and who loses. So there's a tendency sometimes to think that closing an area to trapping or hunting is a takeaway, is a take. You're taking my recreational opportunity. And it's true, you don't get to do it anymore. But we forget about everything we get. We get better water, we get better fish, better habitat. But the other thing too is 4.2 million Oregonians and millions of species depend on water. Less than 170 people in the entire state trap and hunt beaver on public lands. Less than 170. It's not their only recreational activity. And it's about, again, if we go back to the beaver analogy, what do we have to learn from beavers? We have to be generous with each other. We're up against a big thing that's bearing down on us. The weather is changing. And so we absolutely have to begin to partner with this species, because if we don't, we're not going to restore our streams. And if we don't restore our streams, then we're going to find ourselves in really intense water conflicts. So it's not, yes, some people won't get to do it anymore, but they will get the benefits of beavers. And if we don't do something, then the next time, and in years from now, and 5 years from now, when there's another wildfire, that fire is going to rip down and across that dry valley and up the other side, and there will be no safe places. There will be no stored water. There will be no good salmon habitat. So it's really about looking to the future and saying, this is what we need, because our streams have been damaged because of what we have done to them, and enlisting this animal who will fix many of our streams for free. And we just get to reap the hundreds of millions of dollars of benefit. But I'm not going to say, you know, if you love to trap and hunt beavers, yeah, it's a trade-off. And that's where each individual person has to take a really deep personal look and say, how important is my community? How important is my community's future? Do I remember what it felt like when we couldn't breathe? Do I remember what it felt like to see a bunch of dead animals after a fire because there was no safe place? And so we're really at that stage.
So what can listeners do to support this bill?
I think at this point, here is the challenge we are faced. The bill is sitting in the Agriculture and Natural Resource Committee that is chaired by Representative Brad Witt. And Representative Brad Witt, as the chair, makes the decision about whether or not a bill gets a hearing and a work session. That decision has to be made, and the hearing and the work session have to be scheduled before March 19th. That is next Friday. At this point, it is not on the schedule. So if March 19th arrives and this bill is not scheduled for a hearing and a work session, the bill dies. And all those benefits we've been talking about, all those things that we need in order for Oregon to be better prepared for the changes that are coming down the pike, we're not going to get. So what I would say to your listeners is call Representative Brad Witt's office. I know the representative is like, I got 100 bills. Please stop talking to me about this beaver. But he needs to hear from Oregonians across the spectrum. If you're a trapper and a hunter and you're like, I get it. I'm on board. Tell him that too. If you're a rancher or farmer, tell him that. Water's really important to me. I think it's a small trade-off to close part of the state so that beaver can do their dam building in the areas that they can do it well in.
So what's taking Brad Witt so long to deal with this bill?
Well, in all fairness to Representative Witt, my understanding is that his committee has over 100 bills that he is trying to juggle. So one of it is sheer volume. The other thing is that Representative Brad Witt is not a fan of the bill, to be honest. He is the co-chair of the Sportsman's Caucus for the Oregon Legislature, and the Sportsman's Caucus has come out in opposition to the bill, which is incredibly puzzling to me, given that beaver restore the habitat, that the wildlife that the sportsmen and women like to hunt. So it's an odd sort of thing where it's like, you know, I don't want a bill that gives me better habitat for the animals I care about and like to hunt, because some of my friends maybe won't get to trap, even though they're going to have all kinds of benefits as well. So part of it is sheer volume of bills. Part of it is that it is not a priority for Representative Witt. I think he would like the bill to die. He's made it very clear as co-chair of the Sportsman's Caucus that they're in opposition. I think part of it is that there's just this unwillingness to recognize that it is not a take, it is an exchange. We're exchanging things of value. And that Representative Witt and all of his constituents in District 31 stand to benefit enormously because Oregon benefits. I also just think that there is a mindset. And it comes back to that one of your early questions about the difference between the native tribes and the Europeans. There's still this attitude is that wildlife is for us to hunt and trap and eat and use as fur. It is not to partner with and restore streams. And that mindset makes it really tough to think of this rodent that runs around with a big tail and slaps the water and builds these dams as anything more than something to trap for its pelt or just for fun. So it's a mind shift. And the question is whether or not between now and Friday of next week, he says, my responsibility is to Oregonians. I may not personally like beavers, or I might not personally want this bill to go through, but my obligation is to Oregon and to Oregon's fish and wildlife.
Well, if he doesn't let the bill go through, what's the next step?
I guess you could say the next step would be a citizens initiative. Because the truth of the matter is we need beavers so desperately on the landscape that this actually is our third try. Twice before we went before the commission, the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission, to try and make it happen. So we've gone to the state legislature to say, please, we Oregonians need beavers and we need the things they give us. If the state legislature won't do it, that probably is our last step, is that we're going to have to say, all right, Oregonians, we're going to have to do a ballot measure because we're not being listened to, and our rivers and our salmon and our fish and our wildlife and our communities need these services. It's a lot of work, It's not a small thing to ask for a ballot measure. And in truth, what it says to me in this case, because the science, the economics, the needs, the legal and ethical and moral obligations to address things like endangered salmon are so great, that to not pass this bill, to not give it a hearing, is not to do your job. State legislatures are public servants.
We'll keep in touch about what happens and probably talk to you again, whether this bill passes or whether we have to take the next step. It's really great to talk with you, Suzanne.
Thank you so much, Barbara. This has been wonderful.
We've been talking with hydrologist and beaver lover Suzanne Fauti, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCPB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO in the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. Go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Next week, we'll talk about salmon with Mark Kurlansky, author of Salmon, A Fish, the Earth, and the History of a Common Fate. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with a tune that I wrote. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, and remember to socially distance and wear a mask. Spirits asleep in the air, nothing to see, nothing to hear. I watch before me unwind the course of a frozen river of time. Carving canyons in the sand, reshaping the land in the palm of your hand. I sit where the river flows, spirits whisper as the wind starts to blow. Future and past all entwined, a river in motion, yet frozen in time. Carving canyons in the sand, reshaping the land in the palm of your hand.